Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit is now open and in session. God save the United States and its honorable court.
Please be seated. So we will hear argument first in numbers 16-2302 and 16-2615, Gilead Sciences against Merck and Company. Mr. Lampkin, as you might expect, we probably will go a little bit longer than the allotted time, so don't feel needlessly constrained to make your points in a unhelpfully clipped fashion.
Thank you and good morning. May it please the court. In Eli Lilly, this court held that unclean hands requires materiality. The opinion below says that unclean hands, quote, does not require a finding of materiality. And it calls that requirement non-existent. Nowhere is the omission of a materiality requirement more apparent than in the court's treatment of the 712 patent, which appears on page 61 of the court's opinion. The court there doesn't merely say, omit the requirement of finding some nexus between wrongful conduct and some unfair advantage for the wrongdoer in connection with the relief sought.
Maybe the question is, what do we mean by the word materiality?
Yes.
Because one could interpret what the district court said and did in finding unclean hands here as the, you know, the wicked suppression of real evidence as being something that was material here to the very debate between the parties here, the validity of the patent. And so why couldn't that be an understanding, a conception of materiality? I guess what I'm wondering is, you want there to be an actual tangible benefit yielded by the plaintiff or some tangible harm suffered by the defendant. And I'm just trying to understand, is that really necessary if, for example, in TheraSense, besides but-for materiality, there could be just affirmative acts of egregious misconduct, right? If you file a false affidavit with the PTO in an effort to try to, you know, bamboozle the agency to grant you a patent, you're basically done, as I understand it, under TheraSense. Likewise, Keystone, sorry, I'm taking up your time, but
no.
You're going to have time. Keystone, we were only talking about a possible invalidating prior use, not an actual definitive invalidating prior use. And there the Supreme Court said, well, we're barring the courthouse doors in that particular example too, regardless of whether this suppression of evidence there actually would lead to an invalidation of the patent. So I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, what is really the understanding of materiality in your view, given my understanding of TheraSense and Keystone?
Sure. Okay, so our understanding, I should make clear, we're not saying but for causation. But
right.
What we are saying is that there should be some relationship, some nexus, as Judge Bryson put it in her Feindergemeinschaft, some nexus between the wrongful conduct and some unfair advantage, something that relates to the courts not wanting to provide the relief requested because it somehow advantaged them in obtaining that relief. And I think Keystone in particular is a very good example of that.
I'm sorry, this is an unfair advantage actually obtained or potentially obtained had the misconduct not been uncovered and any potential effect wilted?
I think, Your Honor, I believe a potential would be sufficient. And these lines are not precise, but potential would be sufficient.
So but why isn't that present here? And if one thinks of this in either two or three episodes, the 2004-2005 conduct, the 2015 deposition conduct, and then the 2016 trial, starting with the first. The origin story of the February 2015 amendment was something that maybe shouldn't in law have been relevant to any legal issue, but you knew full well that it was going to be relevant. That's why your company had a policy of trying to separate these things. So how is it that a false origin story at the deposition wouldn't have had an effect, and how is it that a improper sequence of participation plus continuation on the docket is unconnected to the potential future litigation?
Well, I think for the 712, the district court actually said it's not connected and I will not rely on it. I'd refer to footnote 5 on page 61, where the court says flat out, the finding of improper business conduct related to the March 2004 call was not considered by the court in determining whether unclean hands prevented enforcement of the 712 patent. And so if you go and see, look after that, what did the district court rely on in connection with the 712 patent? It's not just that the district court used a cast of darkness.
Can I just say,
are you moving away from what Judge?
Okay.
The 712, you're sliding away from the thrust of what the presiding judge is pushing you on.
So back to the 499. I don't think it even had the potential under any legal standard, a correct legal standard or otherwise, of affecting the validity of that patent.
Did it infect the environment of the litigation?
Oh, much to our detriment.
In fact, the validity of patent, you're going to a but-for type of test. Didn't it have an impact on the environment of the litigation?
I don't think it had any possible impact on the outcome. Not an unfair advantage, not a slight advantage. And there's a reason for this. The claims already covered the infringing product when that meeting took place.
Right, but I mean, to try to focus this a little bit. As Mr. Durrett or Dr. Durrett said, it is potentially helpful to go from a broad claim to a narrow claim. The broader claim might have been subject to easier invalidation. So by going from one to the other, you do actually reduce litigation risk. The findings of the district court are that the participation in the call followed by the non-recusal from the docket had an effect on the arrival at the narrowing amendment, which had the potential litigation benefit of being narrower and therefore less subject to invalidity.
Well, actually, Your Honor, the only impact of narrowing was to create an invalidity problem, which is the one we're arguing about today, or potentially on rebuttal, there was a mismatch in the sense that, or the argument that there's a mismatch, the spec was much broader, and the claims are much narrower, and the argument is that there was no written description because the claims don't point you towards...
Right, but by narrowing, you certainly, and Dr. Durrett testified, certainly plausibly enough, that you reduce the risk of, forget about 112, but about 102, 103 invalidity.
Right. The district court didn't rely on there being wrongful conduct linked to any unfair advantage in terms of reducing any particular risk. The district court was unhappy and relied on the fact that in amending the claims, he amended the claims, quote, to cover sevoflurane and metabolites.
What do you do with fact-finding 104? I mean, it seems to me, sir, that these unclean hands pieces are intensely fact-intensive. You can't deny that. And we have a clearly deferential standard of review here. So I really would like you to go back, starting on back around page 12 in the appendix, where the fact findings begin dealing with the fact that Mr. Durrett knew he was going to a meeting, knew at the meeting that the structure of the composition was disclosed, et cetera. And just tell me which of those, you say the fact findings are clearly erroneous, your brief.
Yes.
Which numbered ones are by number, and then tell me why. What's the heart of the clearly erroneous fact line? Because it leads up, as I say, to 104,
where
the court is saying if Durrett hadn't violated had improper business conduct by having been in that meeting, he wouldn't have amended the claim.
Yeah, and I think that one, I should start there.
Well, no, I'd rather not you start. Start around 63 and come forward.
Should I start back at 63 or is it okay?
Yeah,
to start?
Paragraph 63 is where it sort of starts on page 12. Merck directed Durrett to participate in this conference. Is that true, false? I mean, which...
I think it's a buildup
of a lot of facts.
Right. There's certainly evidence that at least Pam Demeen had an email that suggested that Mr. Durrett was to participate.
Tell me the ones by number that you think are clearly wrong, please.
All right. So, by number,
yeah.
I'd start at 39 to 41, which begins with the non-disclosure agreement. And I think the problems with 39 to 41 on the non-disclosure agreement is legal is factual error that comes from a legal error, which is not looking at the terms of the NDA. The NDA did not say that if you attend these meetings, you may never use any information from these meetings. It had a specific definition of confidentiality. And once the information became public, you were allowed to use it, even if you got the information initially from the meeting and you didn't have to get the information from the public.
Okay,
that information just became open. And so I think when the district court found wrongful conduct in amending the claims, the district court said there was a violation of the NDA. But there was no violation of the NDA because the NDA
The district court also said, and it seems to me less vulnerable to the point you just made, that the participation plus the non-recusal was a violation of an understood firewall to keep out of the docket controller knowledge of the subject of the due diligence conversation. So forget about the NDA for now, about which you have a simple and strong point.
So the firewall is always referred to as, and this is paragraph 85 of the findings of fact, it's referred to as the firewall of the NDA. There's no evidence whatsoever that the firewall extended in duration or time or effect beyond.
There is evidence from Dr. Durrett's own deposition that it was Merck's own policy not to have somebody who had a docket related to a conversation if you thought the conversation was going to be about this because it might have a tainting effect, even if, as a matter of law, it shouldn't. But the way written description challenges are litigated, it's undeniable that the origin story does play a role.
Your Honor, I think there's two questions. The first one is the Merck policy certainly says that you should not be in these meetings if it's going to taint you. But it also does not say that once the confidentiality agreement does not apply to information, you are forever barred from patent prosecution. And there is no amendment to these claims until after Clark publishes and after all the information disclosed on the call becomes public. And so both the NDA and the associated firewall had expired. So if you're looking for wrongful conduct, the amendment, and some relationship to an unfair advantage, you've got neither because the NDA permitted the conduct. And there's no wrongful advantage because these claims, the compounds were covered by the initial claims, and the narrowing did not provide any unfair advantage as against Gilead with respect to the relief we sought to Gilead. Merck was entitled to enforce these claims at Gilead from the first day the claims were filed to the end.
Can I ask you this question? Do you have evidence that even if Dr. Durrett had recused after the March 2004 call, and someone else took over the prosecution, that Merck would have, in fact, come to file the same or comparable narrowing amendments yet to cover the PSI 6130?
Yes, absolutely. The first is very similar narrowing amendments were done in the 395 patent, which was a parallel patent that covered the double ring. And then so the similar, and that was in 2003, I believe. And so it made perfect sense to have similar narrowing amendments later on in the 499 patent. And mind you, it was a 712.
We would infer from that would have necessarily happened with regard to the patent the presiding judge is talking about.
I think, frankly, if you look at the patents, it becomes obvious. And in fact, the
I'm confused. Did Dr. Durrett rely on as indicia of why he made the amendment in February 2005 for the 499, referencing whatever prosecution you're referring to for something called the 395?
I think that is mentioned by Dr. Durrett in his testimony, but I think the key thing here is that everybody, this is a narrow space, everybody is watching everybody else's patents. Pharmaset admitted is watching Merck's patents. Merck and Dr. Durrett in particular.
I understand that, but is there something a little more specific that was testified to or otherwise that is evidence that Merck put on that said this was an inevitability as soon as Clark published in early 2005 that Merck was going to write these claims regardless of who would be the author of that amendment, whether it was someone that's arguably tainted like Durrett or some other attorney?
Well, first, I think Merck's position throughout this is that it's an irrelevancy.
I understand that. No, we understand that part.
Yes, no answer to the judge.
And I don't think we put on evidence that said it was actually an inevitability. But the 712, I should point out, that Durrett was long retired. We had a succession of two other patent prosecutors, and they amended it to cover the metabolites.
Put aside for a minute, I guess, something quite important to you, which you already mentioned, which is the footnote in the district court's opinion saying, I'm not actually relying on any of this for the 712. 712 amendment is in 2011, am I remembering that right? And by then, the 499 is actually out, right? It's published, it was issued in 2006. Mm-hmm. So how could there be an independence of the 2011 amendment to the 712 from what had occurred with the 499?
Well, the district court itself, not only in footnote 5, said that she wasn't going to rely on it, but during the hearing, the judge said any effort to trace that amendment back to Dr. Durrett and the 499 was, quote, a dead end. And there's a reason for that. That by the time it was amended in 2011, Sofosbuvir had publications, and we went through two different patent prosecutors, and the trail went cold on tracing it back to the 499. It was because of the publication of Sofosbuvir metabolites. And there's nothing, Mr. Bergman testified that he knew nothing about Durrett or the 499 or anything about that when he went and amended the test.
Bergman didn't know about the 499?
Or anything that he didn't know anything about the prosecution of the 499. He relied on public information when he went and said, I'm going to amend this to cover the Sofosbuvir metabolites.
Can you return to Judge Chen's question about specific findings, contention, evidence that it was an inevitability that Merck would arrive at the February 2005 amendments, even if not in February, sometime later, even if Dr. Durrett had disappeared from the docket?
I think that because both parties, and the evidence is clear that everybody watching everybody else's docket, it was absolutely clear from Clark itself that it was focused on methyl up, fluoro down, nucleosides. Every single one of the examples had that pattern. Every single claim had that pattern. The lead compound, the first example, was PSI-6130. It was the only one for which there was data. Nobody with the background in chemistry that these people have could look at Clark and realize that this was a significant compound they wanted to ensure would be covered.
Did someone from the Merck side testify to all this? I mean, I understand this is your reading of the Clark application, and that very well may be true. I need to know, did Dr. Durrett or someone else paint this very specific picture of the Clark disclosure?
Yeah, I don't believe there was, because I think, as I said, we were focused on, now by rebuttal, I'll give you an answer on that for sure, but we were focused on the fact that it always covered these compounds, and it didn't stop covering the compounds.
But in response to this very specific question that is very important that's been asked by both the residing judge and by Judge Chen, you have given attorney argument for an answer. It's a yes-no answer to the question. Does the record contain any evidence put on by Merck showing absolutely, positively, this all would have happened, you know, even if Durrett hadn't been around? And you've gone in circles. I don't blame you. But it's a yes-no answer.
I think the answer is no. I'm not positive about that.
There is no such evidence.
But
the world is an imperfect place.
Yeah.
Even as Durrett testified, sometimes I learn about this stuff a month later, sometimes later than that. The clipping service that sends the stuff, I don't always get to it. I'm a very busy man. So why is there necessarily, should we accept your attorney argument that this would have happened?
Well, of course, the burden is...
Durrett did testify that he isn't always just, like you would say, I think, glued to the phone waiting for the information about what the competition is doing.
So, of course, the burden is on Gilead to prove by clear and convincing evidence that there was this unclean hands. And we believe that means not just wrongful conduct, but a nexus, some connection to some unfair advantage or some reason why a court would not want to give relief on the claims there. And I just don't think there's any evidence whatsoever or any basis for thinking that, first, the claims would have somehow been narrowed to exclude their compounds absent this meeting, or that the claims really would not have been, I think that's basically it.
It's not necessarily narrowing to exclude. I mean, your storyline is that you didn't even need to amend the claims. The claims always covered the compound,
exactly.
And it was just as a matter of a convenience to the examiner that this was done, even though none of the inventors on the project ever asked for this amendment. They were presumably glued to the phone also to learn about Clark's disclosure. But after Clark's disclosure, isn't the fact finding that none of the inventors came forward and asked to have the claims amended?
I think, Your Honor, there is no evidence that that happened afterwards, but there's powerful evidence that this was...
I'm just saying, when you're talking about the fact that Gilead hasn't put any evidence in, they were the ones that produced the evidence that none of the inventors had asked to have the claims narrowed, amended to this. After all, this is the crown jewel, the thing everybody was looking for. You would have thought that once, I'm now making the argument that you're making, an attorney argument, you would have thought that the inventors glued to the phone and knew about Clark would have jumped on direct, overnight, please amend these claims in a hurry.
And I think that's exactly what happens, Your Honor, because the moment our patent came out, Clark had our patent on hand. When their patent came out, we amended ours.
That may be this perfect world in that, in competition, the way it works, but we're looking for evidence to support the arguments.
Well, I think the answer is this. First, I need to go back to my point, which is that the claims always covered it. If you're looking for an unfair advantage, if you're looking for an impact, you're looking for a potential impact, it's hard to see one. Certainly not one that makes it unfair to Merck for Merck to assert its 499 claims against Gilead. The second
piece... Well, if it was always there, we found it without any blaze marks. We were really lucky. We went in the forest at night with no light at all, but we found the one tree we were looking for.
I'll come to that in 1 second, but I also wanted to make sure that the court was aware. If you look at pages 8 and 9 of our opening brief, this was a compound, the methyl epfluron, that was drawn in the lab notebooks by Dr. Prakash, produced, admittedly, in a protected form with a double ring by Dr. Song. And Dr. Olson, one of the inventors, said he made sure that these were covered because the fact that methyl up was an inhibitor and fluoro down was a substrate were extremely important findings. And so the notion that somehow or another, but for this meeting, that these compounds would have been excluded, I don't think there is even a shred of evidence to support it, much less clear and convincing evidence of the sort that would be required for unclean hands.
I don't understand. I'm trying to figure out. You were getting on a roll there. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
That's why I'm here.
I'm trying to, there was a competing story, a competing narrative that... when it came to scoping down the claims to cover this particular subgenus, there weren't any blaze marks in the written description such that one of ordinary skill reading the written description have sufficient guidance to arrive at this particular patch of this very, very large forest. I told it billions and billions of possibilities. I didn't see you resist that in your yellow brief. And so the concern is that this was derived from the Pharmacet people, this particular claim scope. And now we have a witness that was in the deposition. One could argue that he was making it very, very clear there was absolutely no way he could have been tainted by anything from the Pharmaset camp, whether it was the application or the phone call, because he wasn't on the call. There's just no way. He just was looking to expedite the prosecution. And then in the trial, he continues to say, all right, probably saw it. In fact, no, I must have seen it. I must have seen it, because that's what triggered me. And then he says, this was the most important subject matter to the collaboration. And now the district court judge seems to be set off by that, because the indication or the insinuation from Dr. Durrett is that he's saying that the collaboration team contemplated this particular subgenus when there's absolutely no evidence to that effect.
Oh, no. There is evidence to that effect, which I just pointed out.
Who communicated that to Dr. Durrett, though?
Dr. Olson said that he made sure in the first instance that the methyl up and fluorocom downs were included. And so that had to be communicated to the patent prosecutor.
Included? What does that mean, included? Did someone order Dr. Durrett to say, we want just the fluorine and we just want the methyl up?
So if we're talking about the amendments.
The February 2005 amendment.
And so as a matter of law, when you're looking for a written description, you look at the specification. Ariad makes clear it's the disclosure that matters.
Right now I'm just interested in what was the motivation to make the amendment. Who ordered the amendment?
So it appears that the amendment came from Durrett.
Right.
And Durrett has given a number of reasons why he amended it.
One was expediting, and two was this was the subject matter that was most important to the collaboration.
Right. And
this subject matter, this particular subgenus.
And he also has said that there must have been a triggering event, and he thinks it's likely in hindsight that triggering event was Clark. Although he doesn't remember precisely when he saw Clark, and that was consistent both across his deposition.
Is he trying to have it both ways there? Maybe he saw Clark, maybe he didn't, but Clark must have been the trigger. Do you see the problem there?
Yeah, of course. Dr. Durrett is not a great witness. In trials, you have bad witnesses. This happens. But when you're looking for unclean hands, it's not a bad witness that triggers unclean hands. It's not even an untruthful witness. It is egregious misconduct, which in turn produces some unfair advantage.
Mm-mm. And the problem, not in turn produces. In turn might have produced, might reasonably
Judge,
have
yes.
produced.
Judge Toronto, that's absolutely right. It has a nexus. It has a nexus to an unfair advantage or something, some inequity that says do not give the relief they've sought with respect to that claim.
And what if the judge felt like this was all in an effort to neutralize the origin story as being one of derivation?
Yes.
And so, therefore, we want to minimize our risk that the jury is going to conclude that we lifted this particular subgenus from someone else. And so, therefore, we Merck, are going to tell this story that we were completely untainted by anything from Pharmaset. But once that didn't work, now we will say, we were completely tainted by that, but it was the Clark application that really drove the story, and now the judge is very confused by all of this.
So I should point out that from the outset, and this is in response to interrogatory number 7, which asked us to detail the interactions between Merck and Gilead, or Merck and Pharmaset, we pointed specifically to documents that say Dr. Durrett was on the call. It has been our position throughout. Dr. Durrett was on that call.
Can I just like to double check that? Do those documents refer specifically to the Romer notes? I was a little confused. You say at page 24 of your yellow brief, Gilead produced those notes to Merck before the deposition. What you cite is the Romer notes. And I think what you're indirectly citing is the answers to the deposition, not the interrogatory answers that recite, I don't know, it was like 40 or so documents on the second page, and you say some of, and then in a later legal filing, you say some of those referred to the Romer notes, and you have a quote. But I couldn't quite piece together how we know if it is true that the Romer notes were in Merck's possession at the time of preparation for the, I guess, May 2015 deposition of, of Dr. Barrett. So I know they were briefly in 2004 because Pharmaset asked for them back.
Right. So the reference isn't to the Romer notes. The Romer notes had been produced to us, but what we produced to the other side were a series of emails that said, in essence, Dr., along with Mr. Pons, you and Dr. Durrett.
Right, but I'm asking specifically about the Romer notes because it's perfectly clear from the deposition there was the email a week before, so the call from Ms. Duane, is that her name?
Domain,
right, and maybe even a second email, and those were specifically asked about at the deposition. The Romer notes were not. You say on page 24 of the yellow brief that Merck had the Romer notes even before the deposition of Dr. Durrett. So how could we possibly have been trying to get him to say something contrary to that? We had them, and I'm not quite sure you had them.
Yes, I'm absolutely certain that they were produced to us and they had in our possession. They would not have been shown to Dr. Durrett, I believe, because they were marked confidential at one point, but we had those notes. And so throughout...
Did you respond to the interrogatory with those notes?
No, because we had the notes were produced to us.
Right.
We didn't actually produce the notes.
So it was the domain email and then something else?
It's a series of emails, each of which says that the participants on the meeting will be you, Dr. Pons, and Phil Durrett.
Right.
Or asking them to destroy their notes from the meeting because they had participated. And I, throughout this, you know, there's trial reality and there's reality. The reality is nobody except Dr. Durrett ever had any doubt that he was on that call.
But
Gilead had the same information
we had. I'm trying to figure out, did Merck actually make a proclamation? Like, maybe you would want me to conclude that Durrett was on that call, and we told Gilead that Durrett was on that call before Durrett actually got deposed. As I understand, it was more a collection of documents that were sent over. Inside that collection of documents is an indication that he was planning on being at that call, or he would be on that call, but it wasn't necessarily Merck saying, you want to know who's on that call, Gilead? Let me tell you who's on that call.
Right.
It was Pond and it was Durrett. Those are the two people. See, for example, these documents that support this statement we are telling you now.
Yes. So the actual way it works is when you're responding to interrogatories, oftentimes rather than providing an answer, you say, please refer to the following documents which provide your answers. But you are bound by the contents of those documents. And the contents of those documents could not have been clearer that Dr. Durrett was on the call. If we had thought for a New York minute that there was any doubt about Durrett's participation in that call, then we would have promptly corrected it. But by the end of the deposition, although Durrett was all over the map on this, by the very end, he said very clearly he could not remember whether he was on the call.
His failure to recall happened conveniently after the break. Before the break, he had been confident that he was not on the call. The Romer notes were in the hands of Merck's counsel. They couldn't show them to Durrett because they were confidential. But presumably at the break, Merck's lawyer was able to say, are you really sure that you were on the call? I mean, maybe you don't recall you were on the call, because the I don't recall story happens after the break.
And I think, Your Honor, to the extent that is a fair inference from what happened, that is to the credit of Merck's lawyers. Because what happened here is you've taken a witness who was very bad in a lot of ways. We're not going to deny it. And you basically impute that conduct to a corporation, Merck, which is a respectable corporation, and you impute it one step further to respected trial counsel. And then one step further, you get to the 712 patent, to which none of this relates at all. And with all respect to the district court, I think that is a number of steps too many. Unclean hands should have wrongful conduct associated with some unfair advantage. And if I could ask the court to turn to page 61 of the brief, of the opinion.
And you should actually be thinking about wrapping up at this point.
Okay. The problem with the district court's opinion, this appears both the principal problem on both page 61, where the court's addressing the 712, and page 52, where the district court is addressing the 499. The principal problem is, if you're looking for what is the wrongful conduct, the district court repeatedly points to conduct that is not wrongful. For example, on page 52, the court points to the fact that Durrett testified that the specification fully supported the claims. But no one's ever said that that's false. And the jury actually agreed with it. And that is a critical point here. If you're looking for unfair hands, it has to be wrongful conduct with a link to some unfair advantage, not rightful conduct.
But the district court also was concerned about her view that Durrett lied to her. So she at 5 points, she said, clearly, I don't believe you. You're unbelievable. And she says, I don't, you were lying. And at some stage in the game, probably, a district court is entitled to say to someone that they are convinced is an abject liar, you do not have standing to appear in my court. Because that's basically what unclean hands is all about. It's a standing doctrine. It says your behavior is such that you, for purposes of this lawsuit, it's like you never filed it. We throw the whole thing out.
And frankly,
we have to come to grips with those fact findings, don't we, that she said he was lying.
There's a variety of mechanisms that district courts have to punish bad conduct. And when you have a witness who's a bad witness, there are sanctions, there's contempt, there's a variety of things the district court can do. But unclean hands doesn't exist to punish. Unclean hands ensures that the court does not become an invader of inequity by helping somebody reap the fruits of their transgression. But where the conduct, no matter how bad, doesn't have that critical nexus to the enforcement of the right being asserted, it cannot be done under unclean hands. And I'm going to take Judge Toronto's advice now and find my seat. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May I proceed?
Please.
I will take up where Merck left off. The arguments that have just been presented to the court, both in Merck's brief and at this oral argument, are the exact same arguments that were presented to the district court. And what the district court said, and so I can't say it better than the court, at Appendix 56, lines 2 through 4, what Merck's argument fails to recognize is that the conduct in this case constitutes a systematic and outrageous deception in conjunction with unethical...
Can you get to the specifics? Because,
yes,
you know, one of the things that one can draw from some of the work briefing and otherwise in the case is that it's very easy to move from concrete evidence and findings into more general expressions of outrage, and the latter are really not helpful.
Then let's get to the specifics. One of the questions your honors asked Merck's counsel was, is there any evidence that inevitably these claims would have still been written? And I think he candidly said, I don't think so.
He said there was no testimony.
No,
I think there's a mountain of evidence that companies in this business were looking at each other's publications and patents. They obviously wanted out of a large range of possible products. Suddenly somebody comes and publishes with something that says, we have, I forget what the term was, but very impressive potency data.
Yes.
And you look at that and you say, we have a project for Hep C virus treatment. We read a publication that says somebody has better potency data than anything we have seen. We look at our patent and we say, it's within our invention. How in the world would Merck not have claimed that and eliminated the potential 102-103 problems with the broader claim?
And the answer, Your Honor, is that that's not what happened here. What Dr. Durrett testified was that, and this is cited by the court, again, in Appendix 18, Dr. Durrett admitted that he would not have been able to associate any structure in the Pharmaset application, that's the Clark application, as the structure of PSI 6130, unless he knew the structure of PSI 6130 beforehand.
Right, so two things about that. One, that's limited to Dr. Durrett, and the question that I asked was, how is it that Merck would not have spent more than a few minutes looking at the Clark publication, which is from beginning to end about this, from the abstract to the claims to the drawings to everything, is about a set of variations on this and set with data, the only data in the Clark application is about some version of methyl up, fluoro down, and either, I forget, one or two rings, but there are only two choices. And how is it that Merck, forget about Dr. Durrett, would not have said, this is within our applications, indeed, within one of our earlier, at least one of our earlier claims, the 2002 PCT, claim 8, I guess, and written a claim to cover it?
Because they didn't. We know that that didn't happen because that wouldn't happen because it didn't happen. Merck's position is
Wait one second. That seems to me not to follow. Once the wrongdoer, Durrett, does it, that doesn't tell you what would have happened had he not done it, if he had retired in the fall of 2004.
Then we can only speculate, Your Honor. We could do the same thing with Keystone. So in Keystone, they hid the fact that there was a prior use. And that only went to one of the patents. The court ended up finding that all five of the patents were, as far as the particular defendant was concerned, unenforceable against that defendant because of that behavior. Now, in Keystone, they may have been able to adequately enforce their patents without the cover-up, but they didn't. And so we can't stand here and say, well, if only Durrett had not done this improper conduct, it would have all been okay anyway, because we don't know that. What we do know is what did happen, and what we do know is what Durrett did say. He said, I didn't get it from the Clark application. I couldn't have gotten it from the Clark application without already knowing 6130. He said that at his deposition. The court found that as a matter of fact.
Well, what the district court cites is paragraph 1, is a tiny bit of testimony, is I think page 53 of the deposition, where he's asked a specific question about paragraph 0168 of the Clark, and he says something that actually says two things in a row, and I don't even understand how the two of them go together. But whatever it is, that's limited to paragraph 168. And then 4 pages later in the deposition, there's some discussion of pages 11 to 16 of the Clark application, but those are just reading. Do these words say this? Do these words say this? Do these words? That's meaningless stuff. Did he ever say, I could not have gotten this from the Clark application as a whole?
All I can do is tell you what he said. And Your Honor's right, it's at page 53, but it's actually two places, lines 1 through 6 and lines 22 going over into page 54, line 5. That's what the court cited, and that's specifically at ECS docket number 410, and it's at also appendix 18 of the court's order. She said, Dr. Durrett admitted he would not have been able to associate any structure in the Pharmacet application as the structure PSI 6130 unless he knew the structure PSI 6130
right, and
in
so,
advance.
So this is one of the findings that I think the other side says, aside from being insufficient, is clearly erroneous because both of those two questions are about a single paragraph in Clark, not about the application as a whole.
Correct. And so they're saying that's clearly erroneous. We're saying the court found and was quoting verbatim what Dr. Durrett said.
No, but I'm sorry. It is really important in a case like this to be precise. This finding goes beyond 168. The only testimony cited and the only testimony you're citing is about 168. So to that extent, that finding is clearly erroneous. He did not admit you couldn't get it from the whole Clark application.
He admitted at least what he was being shown at that time, he couldn't get it. That's correct, Your Honor.
I guess he says because this was one compound out of a plethora of compounds in the publication. So is it possible that he's trying to suggest that this publication is huge with a lot of things being discussed, and so he wouldn't necessarily be attracted to whatever is said in this particular paragraph given the overall content of the publication?
That's exactly what he is saying. And now, but let's see what the import of that is. So it's not like Dr. Durrett then came to trial and said, you know what, that wasn't accurate. I looked at the Clark application. I saw 6130 jumped out at me. I saw that it had potent activity, and so I narrowed the claims because of that. He didn't say that at trial. What he said at trial was, at trial, he said, he amended the 499 claims to to focus on getting allowance on the subject matter that was the most important to the Merck-ISIS collaboration. He did not rely on the Clark application in justifying his narrowing.
Let me just ask you about that, and I agree. I've read, I guess, the deposition, and I've read the Clark testimony, and at trial, even more at deposition, to put it mildly, he was on the assumption that he actually saw Clark, that it was the triggering event, he was less than forthcoming about the effect, and he continued to be less than forthcoming at trial about the effect. But the most important statement, Merck and ISIS have a project for Hep C virus. They've covered a lot of different possibilities. They get the first data that says something is extraordinarily promising more than anything else. How would that not be the most important thing in the Merck-ISIS project?
Because
he doesn't say Merck-ISIS was working on this particular compound. He just says it's the most important thing for the collaboration. Namely, somebody has identified, has shown great potency of one of the things that belongs to us.
And he was actually, the Merck-ISIS was looking elsewhere. They were looking at the methylop. They were never looking at the fluorodown. Yes, it was one of billions of compounds that were covered in this massive genus, but they were never looking at the fluorodown. And in fact, what the court specifically found based on
just on that point, are there not some examples with the fluorodown?
There is not one example with the methylop and the fluorodown. Well,
but that's not what you just said. So you keep switching into generalizations that are stronger than the evidence would support. It is, I gather, true that not one of the 154 examples have all three of these things together. Single ring methylop fluorodown in the R2 rather than R3, maybe not even in either one. But there are some examples with fluorodown, and there are some examples with methylop, and there are some examples with the single ring.
Correct, Your Honor. All in separate places. And what our expert testified is if you followed the teachings of the patent, you would be led away from combining a methylup with a fluorodown and a single ring. And one of the reasons, and Jeremy Clark actually testified by way of deposition, that one of the reasons you would move away from it is that one of the problems was toxicity. We're talking about a treatment for hepatitis C. And one of the problems with fluoro is it is even more toxic than methyl. So why would you take a fluoro that is already toxic and combine it with a methyl with the attempt to somehow make something less toxic? And so it was Dr. Durrett finding out that they, meaning pharmacists, had gone in a totally different direction that all of a sudden changed his mind as to what was the most important for Merck. They never, and I will make a broad statement here that is, because it was stipulated to, that they never made, used, tested.
Just to follow up on Judge Toronto's question, I understood his question as suggesting that there's a fair way to interpret what Dr. Durrett said right there about subject matter that's most important to the collaboration as saying once the Clark application popped out, and you saw all this really valuable activity in this one area of Merck's genus, then clearly it would be, therefore, the most important subject matter to the Merck-ISIS collaboration to ensure getting more specific claims that are directed to that really valuable subgenus scope. So I guess the question, therefore, is why isn't that a reasonable, maybe even the more reasonable reading of what Dr. Durrett was trying to convey at that moment in time at trial?
Because that isn't what he testified to. He didn't say it was, he never tied it to the Clark application. The only thing he said about the Clark application was he couldn't glean, be it that one structure, he couldn't glean anything from the Clark application because it was so broad and had so many different potential structures. That's what he testified to. He then testified that he narrowed the claims to cover the most important of Merck's work. And what the court found as
I'm sorry, he didn't say that. He said narrowed the claims to cover something that was the most important to the Merck-ISIS collaboration. That collaboration was were the joint owners of these patent applications. Big
Correct.
Deal.
He did say the Merck-ISIS
collaboration. That's a very big deal, right?
Collaboration.
To the collaboration. He doesn't say most important to, I don't know, what you want to translate it into, the laboratory work of Merck and ISIS.
No, Your Honor, I'm not. I'm just quoting him verbatim when he says it was the most important collaboration. And what the court found, having viewed his demeanor and all of the evidence presented at trial, the court found, as a matter of fact, that it is not credible that compounds that were never made, used, or tested during a collaboration were considered by Merck to be the most important work of the collaboration.
Right. And so the point is that she, the judge, concluded that at this moment in time, Dr. Durrett is trying to convey to the jury with this statement that maybe could be read a couple different ways, that he nevertheless is trying to convey to transmit to the jury, this was really important to the work we were working on, because this is we ourselves contemplated this particular subject matter, so that's why I amended the claim the way I did. He didn't say it exactly in those terms, and so therefore we're trying to figure out if in fact that's how she interpreted it, and then is that a fair interpretation of what he said? Do you see where we are?
I do, Your Honor, and I think that the court made it very clear how she interpreted it, and she interpreted it as a matter of fact. So the standard is, was she clearly erroneous in looking at Dr. Durrett, listening to what he said, looking at his demeanor, and coming to the conclusion that he wasn't telling the truth. He wasn't credible that compounds that were never made, used, or tested during a collaboration were considered by Merck to be the most important work of the collaboration. Was she clearly erroneous there? How can we say sitting here when she was sitting there listening to him and watching him? And that was what she concluded as a matter of fact.
Well, it clearly couldn't have been the most important thing to the collaboration while the collaboration was going on, because they didn't find it, didn't test it, didn't know about it at that time.
That's what she said.
And so in the after effect, looking backwards, once you see what Clark got to tell you about a specific compound, you could say, gee, is that something that we were really trying to find and look for in our collaboration? Of course it was, because it was the gold mine, right? But I read it, five specific points, and she found that Durrett was untrustworthy.
Correct, Your Honor, and she based that on her own view of his demeanor and on the totality of his testimony and the rest of the facts, that they just didn't hold up with his explanation.
What harm befell Gilead other than suffering an infringement verdict against it? What harm fell to Gilead from the misconduct of Merck?
Having to defend against the patents. And that, in fact, is what the court found, is that these patents at issue came as a result of unconscionable actions, and they resulted from these series of...
But I guess what if the patents, despite any shenanigans that happened, what if these claims are, in fact, fully supported by the written description and also fully enabled, and so therefore... Whatever happened here, whatever mischief happened here, didn't actually infect the validity of the patent.
It infected the creation of the patent. And so what the court found, again, as a matter of fact, was that but for, and those were her terms, but for this improper conduct, then they would have never, and I'm going to try to find the exact quote here,
no, it's at fact finding 104.
104, thank you, Your Honor. Yeah. But for the improper participation, he would never have narrowed the claims. That's, again, a finding of fact. Was she clearly erroneous after having heard everything he said? We say obviously not. And that led up to, that was a series of steps. First, she said Dr. Durrett waited for the structure to publish so that he could claim he got it from a publication
Did the district court find that he had the Clark application before February 1st, 2005?
She made no such finding because Dr. Durrett was all over the place as to when he saw it. So she made no such factual finding as to when
he did.
But
then she also made the finding that he waited until the application was published. That's the potential inconsistency in her analysis.
She did that because of the temporal link. 18 days after it was published, he amended the claims without any kind of an office action on the part of the patent office.
We get that, but you know, we're trying to figure out what happened here. One theory is the Clark application didn't influence him. Why? Because he didn't have it. Maybe because he didn't know it. Then the other counters fact is that he did know about it because he was waiting. He was waiting like a hawk for that application to publish. And then once he learned the application published, why wouldn't he likewise also have read it? And then if he had read it, you know, why wouldn't it be painfully clear that the content was directed to 2' methyl up, fluorine down?
The answer.
Can you fit these two pieces together?
I can, Your Honor, which is that there is no explanation, and the court points that out. We never got an explanation from Dr. Durrett why he amended the claims when he did. The patent had been pending, the application had been pending for months. There had been no office action asking them to narrow the claims.
Well, it's not quite true. We never got an explanation. He says, must have been the triggering event. I don't remember, but must have been. What do the district court's findings imply about what the district court believed about whether he had Clark before February 1st, 2005? Your position is, yes, of course he did, right?
Well, Your Honor asked me two questions. So first, what were the district court's findings? The district court findings were, and we can then infer that the district court believed he had the Clark application because the district court said she believed that he waited until it was published and then wrote claims to cover it, and that he waited until it was published to give the appearance that he found it from a public source. And then the next step is, and but for obtaining it improperly, he never would have narrowed the claims. So that's a three-step process. It starts at paragraph 101, 102, 103, 104, as Your Honor points out. And then she goes on. So that goes to the 499. And then she goes on and talks about the business misconduct vis-a-vis the 712.
So what is Gilead's position? Is Gilead's position that, yes, he did have the Clark application before he filed the amendment, and, yes, he looked at it?
I think if we're going to believe that you're looking at your competitor, let me back up. He found out on the phone that it was going to publish because in that phone call they said that they had a patent that covered this structure, and it was soon to be published. So he...
This is in the March, the St. Patrick's Day call?
Correct.
The depot call.
Correct. So, yes, we can assume. I'm trying to be true to the record, since he never admitted one way or another. He said, in hindsight, it must have been the triggering event, but he never said that. And he still waffled on when he saw it and the impact that it had on him. But he was very clear that Clark application aside, his motivation for narrowing the claims wasn't because of the Clark application. It wasn't a Kingsdown situation. He never testified that, I saw it. I saw they were doing something we already covered, and I wanted to make sure it was clear with the patent office, so I went down and amended the claims.
Can I ask you, before you turn to the 712, which
yes,
is
Your Honor.
An important thing, the district court said at finding of fact 116, and I think was pretty much just picking up on something in your proposed finding 171. Your proposed finding is at 22090 of the appendix, and I'll read yours. Patent attorney Durrett did not say, you're talking about the deposition, did not say that he did not remember a call or that he could not be sure, but instead definitively stated, I wasn't on it. It seems to me the second half is true and the first is false. He said, I will now personally guess, several dozen times, I don't recall. At the beginning of the deposition, and then he transitions in the sort of page 29 to 38 range to being very sure because he searches his memory, he says, and he would have remembered it, and he doesn't remember it, so it must not have happened. And then later on, your own attorney essentially does a follow-up at right near the end, 177 or something, and he says, I want to be sure. Are you saying you weren't on the call or you don't remember? And I roughly half a dozen times he says, I don't remember, I don't remember, I don't remember, I don't remember. So what were you doing saying to the court, Durrett did not say that he did not remember a call?
So that finding of fact that Your Honor's talking about at page 116, I mean at paragraph 116,
yes.
That comes after the court is quoting specific Q&As from Dr. Durrett, where he's asked, are you sure of that? Meaning, are you sure you weren't on the call? Yes. How are you so sure 11 years later that you were never told what the structure was for the 6130 compound? The answer is the structure was not revealed to me by individuals at Merck or otherwise. I'm positive
right,
of that.
Right. So the true thing to say about the deposition is that he said 25 times or so, I don't recall, and he said maybe 8 or 10 times, I wasn't on it. He said both things. So what were you doing saying to the court he didn't say the first thing?
What we were talking about is quoting when he was absolutely, positively, 100% sure. And His Honor, Judge Clevenger is right. There was a break. It doesn't reflect how long.
That's why I mentioned pages 1 to 29, where he said, I don't recall, before he somehow transitioned into being sure of himself.
Is what 116 is saying, with respect to the foregoing 113114, he did not say he did not remember. That is to say he was certain, as opposed to saying he did not remember.
Correct,
Your Honor. As opposed to saying that I think what the presiding judge is talking about is the possibility that 116 could be interpreted to mean that at no time during his deposition did he ever say he didn't recall, which you would have to agree would be incorrect.
That is correct.
But definitely, if you look at 116 to say what 116 is trying to say is, Dr. Durrett did not say above, he did not say he did not remember. It's a contradistinction between not recalling and saying directly.
Correct, Your Honor. She's
that's what I understood you to be saying, how you read 116.
Yes, and that's how we read it, is she was talking about the passages right before it.
If 116 were read, on the other hand, to say that at no time during his deposition did he ever say, I did not recall being on the call, that, of course, would be incorrect.
That's right, Your Honor. We are not
because
saying
your own counsel is the one that allowed him after the break, and his counsel got him to start not recalling, which was a smart thing for them to do, right? And you nailed that down at the end.
And then, Your Honor, that's not the only place where the court discusses Dr. Durrett's, whether he's sure or not sure about being on the call. If we then go to page 47, and from 47 and 48 and 49 of the court's opinion, the court at length, again, quotes Dr. Durrett, and not just, how could you be so sure you weren't on the call? Not just he was sure he wasn't on the call, he gave a lengthy explanation as to why he wouldn't have been on the call. And that is what the court found particularly offensive, in fact, described as sanctimonious. I couldn't have been on the call. It would have been wrong for me to be on the call. I was prosecuting the Merck ISIS docket. If I'd gotten on the call, it would have been a conflict of interest. It could have tainted my judgment. He went on and on about why he could not have possibly been on the call. And that, the court, again, after that, made lengthy findings of fact, starting at line 11 on page 49, and comparing what he said at his deposition to what he said at trial, and finding again that he was just not credible. That the bottom line is that Dr. Durrett denied being on the call. His counsel did a good job of getting him to back off a little bit and say, well, I don't remember. But at the time, the only reason that he would have denied being on the call is to hide the fact that the structure was obtained improperly. And they did everything in their power, and the court so held that they did everything in their power to try to cover that up.
Can you talk about the 712 now?
Yes, I will, Your Honor. So first of all, I want to clear up something that counsel said, which is that there was no misconduct findings as to the 7112. Actually, the court did find that there was business misconduct as to the 7112. There is this footnote.
What?
So the footnote
where?
Simply reads, the court's finding...
Oh, could you give us the page?
Oh, I will, site? Absolutely. So we start with page 16, paragraph 91E of the court's opinion.
Okay.
But the footnote is on page 61, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. So we work up to the footnote. So to put the footnote in context, let's see what the court said about business misconduct vis-a-vis the 712. At page 16, paragraph 91E, Merck was required to recuse Dr. Durrett from further prosecution of the Merck ICIS patent applications, plural, in order to comply with Merck's obligations. 91F, Merck and Dr. Durrett's failure to recuse Dr. Durrett from further prosecution of the Merck ICIS patent applications, plural, was an improper business practice. Now we move to page 45.
And just to be clear, Dr. Durrett was never on the 712 application.
Oh, no, he filed it.
He filed the 712?
Yes, he filed the 712.
When?
He filed the 712, I believe, shortly before he retired. So that would have been around
2010?
Yeah, 2010 or so.
But when he filed the 2010, were the original claims filed covering or specifically targeting 2-methylfluorine damage?
Not specifically targeting,
that
no.
Was later in time.
That was later in
by
time
someone else.
Where Mr. Bergman picked it up.
Okay.
But basically, there would have been nothing for Mr. Bergman to pick up if Dr. Durrett hadn't filed the application. So what the court found vis-a-vis the 712, specifically, if we go to page 45, line 27, through page 46, line 8, the court said, and I won't read the whole thing, but the bottom line is it was in fact wrong for Merck to allow Dr. Durrett to continue to prosecute the 499 and 712 patent applications.
Oh, that's at line 12?
11, 12, line 46.
Yes, Your Honor. And then also on page 46, lines 10 through 13, Merck's subsequent decision to allow Dr. Durrett to continue to prosecute the 499 and 712 with full knowledge of the structure of Pharmaset PSI 6130 constitutes unacceptable business conduct. And then the court finishes on that same page at lines 21 through 23.
I'm sorry, which page are we on?
I'm 46, Your Honor.
46.
I'm going too fast.
46,
I apologize.
Right. Okay.
I've got this clock in front of me that's telling me.
We have not been that strict. You probably have about 5 or 6 minutes.
All right, I'll slow down then. On page 46, lines 10 through 13, the court then says, Merck's subsequent decision to allow Dr. Durrett to prosecute the 499 and 712 with full knowledge of the structure of PSI 6130 constitute unacceptable business conduct. And then the court goes on, that same page, page 46, lines 21 through 23, saying, and this
ties
is,
it to Keystone.
Ties it to Keystone, that these patents that resulted from this series of unconscionable acts are now asserted against Gilead, which is then the harm to Gilead, a Pharmaset successor in interest.
Patents in the plural.
And she, at first she only refers to it in the plural, but then she specifically, in case there's any doubt about it, she calls out the 712. And she says that Merck's failure to have Dr. Durrett recuse himself after he improperly learned the structure was business misconduct as to the 712. Now, how do we then read footnote 5 that appears toward the end? All footnote 5 says, and I'll read it verbatim, it's on paragraph page 61, the court's finding of improper business conduct related to the March 2004 call was not considered
so
by
you want,
the court.
You want to separate that from what happened after the call.
Exactly. So she's saying the call, that goes to the 499. His saying I'm within the firewall. His not telling him I'm prosecuting.
And only the 499 was even pending at the time.
Exactly. So couldn't have gone to the 712 at that point because the 499 was the only one pending. Then his failure to recuse himself and Merck's failure to have him recuse himself now taints going forward, including the filing of the 712 application. So the court found unequivocally there was business misconduct as to the 712. And that footnote is only talking about the actual call itself and not using that vis-a-vis the 712. So I wanted to clear that up because I think it's a very important point.
To the extent that the call is taken off of the table with regard to improper business conduct with regard to the 712, is the trial testimony that raises the inference for the derivation issue, that applies both to the 712 and the other patent, right?
Correct.
Because they have the common spec, and the WD argument, if it succeeds, impales both patents, right?
Correct, Your Honor. And let's say, hypothetically, the Dr. Durrett innocently got on the call. Let's say getting on the call wasn't business misconduct. It was, and the court so found. But let's say he innocently did. He didn't know that it was going to be an NS5B inhibitor. The court found he did. He didn't know there was a firewall. And so he innocently gets on, and now he hears the structure and realizes it's dead center in the Merck ISIS work that he is handling. At that point, no business misconduct has taken place, hypothetically. His failure to recuse himself and Merck's failure to have him recuse himself now taints everything going forward.
But just why is that necessarily so if, hypothetically, the Clark application is somehow, its disclosure is verbatim word for word for every word that he heard on that phone call. And so, and then it's public information, he reads it. Yes, it's still him that after that files the amendment, but I guess, is there a way to detaint a tainted person thanks to the fact that now the information is free and clear for all to see, including Dr. Durrett himself?
And the answer is no, there is not a way to detaint
Why
a tainted
not?
Person. Because once he learns that he has a conflict, and the same thing happens to we attorneys all the time. We're representing one person. We're in the middle of a discussion. We learn for the first time that that person's going to implicate another one of our clients.
Well, let me ask a slightly variation. Even if Dr. Durrett was not detaintable, why wasn't Merck detaintable?
They would have been if he had recused himself, but he didn't. And that's why we're here. There were multiple steps along the way where we didn't have to end up where we ended up. Recuse Dr. Durrett and don't tell the next prosecutor who picks it up what Dr. Durrett learned, we wouldn't be here. Dr. Durrett continues to prosecute. Don't lie at your deposition. I don't know if we'd still be here if he hadn't lied at his deposition. Once you're caught lying at your deposition, don't come into court and lie to the court. Well, but he did. And once his attorneys know that he's going to recant, tell someone, tell the court that he's going to recant. Don't wait, as the court found in her opinion, for opening statement to give a heads up that Dr. Durrett's going to be changing his testimony. And, you know, I was faced with cross-examining Dr. Durrett. It was like drinking from a fire hose. I had no idea what next. He would come up with these page-long, non-responsive answers to simple yes or no questions.
Well, right at the beginning. No, he had at the beginning of his trial testimony, and I mean, he had his story he wanted to get out, and he found the first more or less appropriate question to get it out. But you knew that the story was going to come, or he was going to repeat the story from the deposition, right?
It was going to be one of the two.
And do I remember right? You canceled the depositions of the 30B6 witness about the due diligence?
Correct.
And even though that would have been Merck's official's testimony about that call.
In retrospect, maybe we shouldn't have. We might have gotten yet a third story as to why the claims got narrowed.
But you don't think it's fair that both sides knew after, at least after May of 2015, exactly what the evidence was going to be, and you just stayed silent about each other, you hoping to create this wonderful credibility problem basis for a trial that otherwise would be focused elsewhere, and they're waiting just to spring the cleansed version, or not quite cleansed, but a much more clean version at trial.
Well, Your Honor, we only knew that Dr. Durrett had lied at his deposition. We did not know what he was going to say when he came to trial. And that, with my limited time, if I could clear that one issue up also, Merck is trying to make it sound like we injected Dr. Durrett into the case. Merck actually all along intended to call Dr. Durrett.
Did they move to exclude his testimony at trial?
They did not. What they moved to exclude was the fact that when he was on the call, he was under a confidentiality agreement. That's all they moved to exclude. They told the court at the pretrial conference that they would be calling him at trial. And when they agreed to make him available for us to call first, it was only under the condition they be allowed to do their direct examination at
just,
the same
time. Just to clarify, didn't they file motions in limine to clear out all of this testimony about anything that has to do with the prosecution? Because in the end, all that really matters is the content of the application vis-a-vis the subgenus claims?
What they moved to exclude were our equitable defenses, that we weren't allowed to argue to the jury any of our equitable defenses. They did not move to exclude. They were successful in getting the court to have the jury not answer the derivation question if the jury found we hadn't met our burden on written description or enablement. They never moved to exclude, for example, Dr. Durrett. They fully intended to call him. They told the court that at the pretrial conference. And what did they intend to call him for? Exactly what they used him for, which was to testify as to written description and enablement, and that the claims were, in fact, fully enabled and fully supported by the written description. And that they did at length at appendix citations 19948 through 19954, and then stood up. And it was interesting to hear counsel for Merck say, we all agree Dr. Durrett was a bad witness. Merck stood up in closing and said to the jury three times that Dr. Durrett was an honest man. They vouched for him three times. And so when the court found that they made him a centerpiece of their case from opening statement to closing argument, that was factually correct. They did.
Can I ask you a question that comes from an observation, if not a holding, by the district court at the end of her opinion that there hasn't been any attention focused on in the briefs or at the oral argument? On page 64, talking about the balancing of equities, at line 17 through 19, the court says there was a significant public harm regarding false testimony and improper business conduct that permeated this suit. The notion of public harm resonates with what the Supreme Court has talked about why it is sometimes unclean hands is found. What do you have a sense of what she was talking about, what the nature of the public harm is?
Yes, very much so. Dr. Durrett was an attorney. He was an officer of the court. That's one of the things she found was so egregious, is that when an officer of the court comes into court and takes the most important oath you can take, to tell the truth and nothing but the truth, and then proceeds to lie, the public is harmed. The entire judicial system is harmed. Essentially, the judge did not come to this issue lightly or quickly.
And what about the public harm regarding the improper business conduct?
That is very interesting, because the public harm there is that no business is going to want to go into any kind of a collaboration with another business if they can't trust that the information they're exchanging will not be used for improper purposes. You're going to end...
Is this the notion that within the industry people respect various firewalls and they respect the confidentiality agreements, because why on earth otherwise would somebody deliver over their specific compound? Unless
exactly.
They can be sure that it's only going to be used in a friendly way.
And it's critical to research in the pharmaceutical industry, where you've got a little company like Pharmacet, for example, and a huge company like Merck. They need Merck. They need the bigger companies to help them do their research.
Was there discussion anywhere at the trial about the nature? I can understand the public harm regarding false testimony. I wouldn't need testimony to me to be able to write an opinion in which I would say that certainly was involved in this case. But what about the role of confidentiality agreements and collaborations, the role of firewalls? Was there any testimony at trial about that as an industry practice?
Yes, Your Honor. There was substantial testimony about it and how this...
Where might I find that? Which witness or... So I realize that the briefs didn't focus on this point, but it does seem rather important to me if there's public harm from private conduct. The court can't ignore that.
If we look, I believe, at page 57 of the court's opinion, the court's talking about Kingstown, and we look at lines 13 Well, let me preface it. She said, Dr. Durrett testified he amended the claims to cover the most important compounds and so on. When pressed at trial, he refused to cleanly admit that he amended them to cover structures you saw in the Clark application, et cetera. Then she goes on and talks about, even if that were not the case, the court finds Kingsdown's holding is premised entirely on the assumption that a patentee learns of a competitor's product through legal and ethical means. Here, Merck learned PSI 6130, Pharmacet's crown jewel, during its, and that was the actual testimony at trial, was that it was its crown jewel, during its due diligence of Pharmacet.
Bring the marketplace to a halt, I see that.
There we go. That's where the court, she doesn't give transcript citations, but she's basing that on the testimony that was heard at trial.
Can I ask another question?
Why not?
Thank you, Mr. Presiding Judge.
This is a town hall meeting.
This is, yeah, more like a committee hearing today. Going back to the kind of jack-in-the-box fun zone of Durrett's deposition, at 822.349, page 71 of the deposition, the judge at one part, in one place in her opinion, also points to this particular testimony as casting doubt on whether Dr. Durrett would have thought the Pharmasat publication to be important. And I couldn't quite understand what he meant here. This is page 71 of the deposition at A22349. And this is where...
Which line are we talking about?
Well, it starts at line 8.
By the way,
this is where Dr. Durrett appears to be volunteering some insights about what he would understand from the Clark application. He's saying how the base, can be purine and a pyrimidine. I don't know if I'm pronouncing this correctly.
Yeah, you are, Your Honor. That's a single base or a double
right.
base.
Right, and then the questioner asks, well, why does this matter? And then he answers that the definition of B would have been indefinite because of such a large number of structures. So it would have had no impact even if I'd seen that publication in my narrowing the definition of B to a pyrimidine ring. And I just want to make sure I understand this answer correctly because it feels like it's a binary choice, right, between a single ring and a double ring. So what is, can you understand what Dr. Durrett is suggesting here, that it would be indefinite because the application is directed to both the single ring and versions that are double ring?
I would guess that what that means is because it's directed to both, you've taken potentially a billion compounds and doubled them into 2 billion compounds. Because if you're only focused on single ring, then obviously at least you've gotten the base out of the way and now you can figure out the sugar, which is still billions of compounds. But if you could either have an infinite number of sugars with two different bases, then you've just doubled your amount of compounds. That's my guess. It's not the cleanest answer in the world, but...
You don't think that the Clark application was indefinite?
No, I do not. No, Your Honor, I definitely... May the record reflect, no, I do not.
That's another case, I think.
For another day. The court has no further questions.
No further questions.
Thank
you very much. Mr. Lampkin, 10 minutes. I think that roughly evens things out, but it's going to be...
Thank you for indulging that 10 minutes. We've gone a while already. So I wanted to start with the 712 and whether or not you can find wrongful conduct that somehow gives any unfair advantage, anything that taints the 712. And the difficulty is this. The district court does not find anything, any change to the 712 that traces to Dr. Durrett, that Dr. Durrett proposed, that has a linkage in any way, shape, or form to any of the misconduct. The only thing the district court identifies, and this is page 61 of the opinion, is that they share a common specification and that Dr. Durrett filed both of the applications. But neither of those produced any wrongful harm, any to Gilead, or any advantage to Merck. The specification is shared. No impact in the specification itself is untainted. It traces all the way back to 2002 before any of these events happened. That Dr. Durrett filed both. Unless Dr. Durrett does something to bring Gilead's invention within the claims, you cannot argue that somehow or another Gilead was harmed by the changes to the 712. But none of the changes to the 712 occur until 2011, when we're two patent prosecutors past Mr. Durrett. And the ability to trace anything back to Dr. Durrett or any misconduct, the trail runs cold. So what does the district court have next on the 712? That the 712 and the 499 are asserted in the same case. And that for that reason, if the district court only renders the 499 unenforceable, Merck will escape without a penalty. And that, I think, gives up the problem with the district court's decision.
712 lies in the ambit of the Merck-ISIS collaboration, doesn't it?
Certainly, and it's, I would not say that they're totally unrelated.
And if there was business misconduct with regard to that collaboration.
Of course, but I think when we're talking about the nexus, and I think the Judge Bryson's articulation of the nexus is probably on the map best, you're looking for a nexus between wrongful conduct and some unfair advantage in granting the relief that is sought by the party. And the mere fact that
there's the same possible connection to derivation arguments and whatnot applies to both patents.
Right, but I don't
think possibility that you will have muddied the waters and you've made Gilead's problems in dealing with its potential challenge on derivation muddier and more confused that Durrett did all of that. And that applies to both patents.
Well, I think that would be at the point where we're...
That's for you, that's far too remote.
It's
extant. You can't deny that there is possible impact on the litigation of the derivation argument because of this back and forth from what Durrett did, right?
I think that reduces, Your Honor, to the notion that there's a possible impact because they're in the same case and they share a specification. But the in the same case cannot be enough because I think that would be contrary both to Keystone and this court's decision consolidated.
It's in the same case and it's conduct that does impact in a more general way than you want to think the law permits.
Yeah. I think if one have just, it has some tangential relationship, it's in the same case, they share a spec, and that's enough, then I think that we have a much harder case.
And from the perspective of your adversary and of the court, Durrett, he sullied the environment. He fouled the ground of the courthouse.
I think,
and he wasn't responsible for filing the application in this other patent. So why isn't it sufficient that the remedy is, as I said earlier, if you view unclean hands as a standing doctrine, are you entitled? You have in personam jurisdiction, your client, to stand in front of a court and ask for any form of relief when you are responsible for the kind of conduct that the court found. Why is it wrong to say, no, you're out of here. Well, come back some other case, but your patent isn't unenforceable forever. This is not an equitable conduct.
Right.
You lost standing.
And I think the answer comes from the case law, which is that unclean hands does not exist to render the property owner an outlaw. It does not mean he no longer has rights. And so the fact that you have unclean hands that infect one patent does not mean that your other property right, it's a distinct property right, somehow becomes unenforceable.
But it's a distinct property right that is not entirely unrelated.
Yes, it's not entirely related, but I think Consolidated Aluminum is actually very insightful on this one, because when Consolidated Aluminum looks at Keystone, it says, in Keystone, for each claim and each patent, there was a direct impact, a direct effect that affected the equity of what the relief was being sought. And in that case, they'd use an ill-gotten decree in order to get the imposition of a very, very onerous set of bonds with respect to every single one of the patents. And that analysis in Keystone of having to find an impact on each and every one
of
the patents.
Keith, am I remembering right that, and maybe it's been studied, I'm sure it's been studied more carefully than I, but the Supreme Court opinion about the bond, or the mention of the bond, I think is kind of one passing sentence. Yet Downey 2 and 3 or 3 through 5 or something just they get captured within the court's ruling.
And they get captured precisely because the district court finds that there was an advantage with respect to all of the patents because an ill-gotten decree was used to impose an onerous bonding requirement with respect to all three patents. And I think Consolidated Aluminum's analysis of that is actually very good, and as well as Judge Bryson's, I would add. But Consolidated Aluminum itself would also be inconsistent with saying, oh, same case, therefore same patent. Because
right, but there's clearly more than that here, sure. Right? This is not just same case. This is same spec. By the time you file the whatever the application was that led to the 712, whoever files it knows that it too can be amended, as it was indeed the next year by Dr. Durrett's successor, to do exactly what was done with the original 2002 application to become the February 2005 amendment.
I think Judge Toronto at that point...
Not exactly the same, but to narrow it to, in a similar way. They're not right. Identical claims.
Right? But I do think at that point, Your Honor, we are in the land of not the district court's actual opinion, but speculation that somehow this was a stalking horse in 2007 that was put up because they're going to amend it later in 2011.
No, because you don't need additional... wrongfulness or scheming, only the absence of a certain break in the chain of causation.
Right. I don't think that the district court found a break, a continuity in the chain of causation from the business misconduct through to the 712. I think that's entirely absent. The district court used the phrase, the trail ran cold, that it was a dead end to try and chase the 712 to Durrett. So what the district court's left with is common specification. But that specification is from 2002. It is untainted.
Was there testimony about the 2011 amendment in the 712 and from the, Bergman, is that
yes.
Bergman?
Yes, Bergman testified that Bergman testified, and the district court did not rely and did not find that Bergman in any way had gotten any information from Durrett or otherwise that in any way tainted the 712, which is why you have that footnote, which says, I can't trace it to the business misconduct. And any effort to trace it to, for example, the fact that he continued his prosecution, as filed in 2007, the 712 did not cover the sabosphere metabolites. It simply didn't cover them. It wasn't until 2011 when a separate, completely untainted patent prosecutor, two steps removed from Durrett, amended it. And I think that just goes too far. It's one thing to say Durrett was a difficult, difficult witness, to say the least. To impute that to Merck, and then to Merck's counsel with some sort of a scheme to defraud when they offered the 30B6 witness, when they actually provided in the interrogatory response clear statements that Durrett was there and therefore was required to destroy his evidence, and then go to counsel, and then all the way over to the 712 patent where the connection is so remote, simply goes too far.
And what do you make specifically of the passages, which I don't remember being highlighted in the briefs, but were highlighted very much by Ms. Brooks, page 49, and other places where there is actually some specific reference by the district court to the misconduct in non-recusal extending to all of the applications, including the 712.
So obviously when the district court has her conclusions of law and reasons, those are not cited, and so they weren't focused on. But I think the difficulty with those is the same as the difficulty you find throughout, is that either you're missing the wrongful conduct on one side, for example, the fact it's a common specification, or the fact that he testified that there was written description, not false. Or you're missing on the other side the nexus, the critical nexus, the essential necessary nexus to some unfair advantage, which means the court that says, I can't give you relief because I would be abating inequity. But if the patent itself is not tainted, if it knows not a product, if it has no relation in that sense to the inequity that underlying it, then you go too far in saying that unclean hands means I'm going to punish because otherwise you wouldn't have a penalty. You would suffer no loss. And that was the final bit of the district court's analysis, which is, gosh, it would be bad if this happened because Merck would suffer no penalty. But there's other ways to penalize misconduct. There's sanctions. There's contempt.
She also said it cast a darkness over the entire litigation.
Yes.
A little dramatic, I understand, but it's more than just I need to punish this Merck.
And I think that casts a darkness rationale gives away the fact that the district court wasn't applying materiality, because materiality requires a nexus between the wrongful conduct and some unfair advantage, some potential impact. And for the 712 in particular, it's just not there. And even for the 499, the district court, and at page 52, cites rightful conduct as the basis. If there are no further questions, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case is submitted.
As the Godfather would say. Mm-hmm.